The conflict in Ukraine has been fought as much online as it has on the battlefield. Whatever Russia's lacking in military force on the ground, it's tried to make up for in the war for the narrative. As recently as this weekend, the Russians were denying responsibility for any attacks on civilians. And, well, actually, denying the entire war.
This is not a war. This is a limited operation.
Welcome to a parallel reality, where facts are batted away and conspiracies abound.
This is not true. This is not true. It's a fake. Believe me, we're all living not only under the circumstances of military operation. We're living in a severe informational war, and war of fakes.
The conflict's been rumbling on now for more than 3 months. Atrocities that once shocked are now weekly occurrences. But one particular story stands out. We're looking through the front windscreen of a car driving down a street in Bucha, a city on the outskirts of the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. Normally it's a busy place, but today, April 1st, 2022, the streets are empty. The Russian military pulled its troops out of here after a month-long occupation. And this is one of the first videos recorded in the newly liberated city. The driver mutters, "Just so you get an idea of what happened here." What he's referring to are the bundles along the side of the road. There's one every few metres, almost as regular as lampposts. They're the bodies of local residents. Many still have their hands tied behind their backs. More than 1,000 people are found dead in Bucha. The evidence seems clear. Satellite images show corpses lying in the street days before the Russian occupiers left the city. But the Kremlin say not a single civilian was injured on their watch. Instead, the Russians are the victims of an elaborate hoax, as Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov explained to Sky News.
Those dead bodies there were not victims of Russian military personnel. We still insist that those pictures were made after Russian troops were withdrawn from that area.
The reason I'm telling you the story of what happened in Bucha is because this event, and so many others like it, are being contested. Not just by the Kremlin, but by a number of people here in Britain who, even in the face of such compelling evidence to the contrary, seem to give credence to the Russian stories of false attacks and staged massacres. Perhaps most worrying of all is that some of them are from the very institutions that are centres for evidence-based logic, our universities. These are academics who've shared Russian disinformation, the same people who are responsible for shaping young minds and influencing the way the next generation understands the world they live in. MP Robert Halfen was worried enough about academics spreading misinformation to raise the issue in Parliament.
Will my honourable friend contact these universities directly to stop them acting as useful idiots for President Putin's atrocities in the Ukraine? Yeah.
The Minister for Education, Nadim Zahawi, seemed to acknowledge the problem.
The Minister for Universities is already on the case, Mr. Speaker, and is contacting those universities. Putin and his cronies are a malign influence on anyone in this country buying their false narrative. And I have to repeat, it is a false and dangerous narrative, and we will crack down on it hard.
So who are these academics, and what makes them prepared to entertain the Russian version of the war?
My name's Justin Schlossberg. I am a reader in journalism and media at Birkbeck, University of London.
He's being modest here. He actually runs the Department of Film, Media and Cultural Studies. And in his spare time, he tweets a lot, most recently about the conflict in Ukraine.
I'm one of these people who believes first and foremost that the Russian invasion was an act of inexcusable aggression. I've long been very concerned about both the nature and extent of the disinformation strategies and campaigns of the Kremlin under Putin's leadership. But I'm also concerned about disinformation that can sometimes come from Western governments, that can sometimes be spread and amplified by Western media.
The most obvious way that manifests itself, according to Justin Schlossberg, is through persuasive propaganda, which has a silencing effect on dissenting speech.
By basically making it clear that if you say anything other than what the kind of Western official line is, then you are playing into Putin's hands. Now, I think that that is very dangerous and problematic framing. I think it has a very close resemblance, actually, to what happened in the US in the 1950s and early 60s under the so-called McCarthyite era, where really anyone that was critical of US foreign policy in the Cold War was labelled as some sort of Russian agent. And there's a word for that. It's called authoritarianism.
Dr. Schlossberg faced strong reactions on Twitter after he raised questions about potential war crimes in Ukraine. There was this one particular tweet he posted shortly after the Russian military pulled out of Bucha. He shared a video originally posted online by Russian state media, and he wrote,
"No mention of video uploaded by Bucha's mayor on 31st of March in which he celebrates liberation."
What's your understanding of what happened at Bucha?
I have no idea. My only understanding is that I think no one else really knows what happened. I think there is a very strong likelihood that there were very serious atrocities, almost certainly the vast majority of which were committed by Russia. But of course, the information I posted wasn't false. Let's just kind of drill down into facts here.
The facts are that the mayor of Bucha posted a video on Facebook celebrating the Russian military withdrawal from his city. And in that video, he doesn't mention anybody's lying in the street. Dr. Schlossberg highlighted this in his tweet. How could the mayor have failed to refer to such an atrocity? Surely something's up. Russian media was using the video to give weight to the idea that the bodies appeared after they had left the city. And the Kremlin continues to cite the video as evidence that the massacre in Bucha was staged.
We've seen repeated attempts to justify some of the most atrocious acts, allegations of war crimes, with false claims and lies, particularly from the Russian side.
Mariana Springs, the BBC's specialist disinformation and misinformation reporter. And she's one of a small group of dedicated journalists who've been looking into the claims that Ukrainians put the bodies in the street in Bucha to blame the Russians. And on the very same day that Justin Schlossberg posted his tweet, she was looking at fresh evidence.
That date, the 4th of April, that's the same date that satellite imagery became available that shows us that the bodies lying there in Bucha, the ones with their hands tied together, had been lying there before Russia had left Bucha. He doesn't add those to his thread, even when they're highlighted to him by people replying to his tweets. And I think what it tells us is a lot about how mis and disinformation operates through omission.
It's worth saying here that there's a difference between disinformation and misinformation. Disinformation's deliberately seeking to mislead. It's what the Russians are accused of doing when they say the Ukrainians are faking attacks. Misinformation's accidental. You didn't realise the facts you were sharing were wrong. So the video, taken on its own, the mayor's comments might look confusing. Mariana says highlighting one inconsistency without mentioning all the other facts can be really misleading.
It's fair enough to point out, oh, I'm quite surprised that a mayor didn't mention this when they were talking about the cleanup of the town. But why not also include the other things that people are reporting on, which are evidence of a lot of the allegations being made? And this is, again, how the misinformation works. You are distorting the narrative.
Even inadvertently.
Inadvertently. It might not be your intention.
And the consequences?
If you have a decent following or profession or a title that means that people are likely to trust what you're saying, you play a part and you can't pretend that you are not a weapon of this war if you do that on social media.
What are the dangers of doing that?
Quite frankly, in Russia's case, they're being used time and time again to deny war crimes, and people are having the realities they are experiencing denied to them. And that's on top of the terror they've had to live through.
So I'm scrolling through Justin Schlossberg's tweets about Bucha, and I can see some people have pointed out facts to him. And then if I scroll down to 2 days later, on the 6th of April, Justin Schlossberg's posted another article, which again makes suggestions that there are inconsistencies with the bodies, even after evidence to the contrary has been shared with him.
as we say in journalism, if one guy says it's raining outside and another doesn't, your job as a journalist is step out and look up into the sky and find out what's happened.
Paul Mason was for many years a colleague of mine here at the BBC. Although he's still a journalist, he's also become a left-wing campaigner, and he joined Jeremy Corbyn's second leadership campaign. But he became disillusioned with that faction of the Labour Party. These days, he's busy writing books and fighting disinformation. And a few months ago, he was in Ukraine speaking to local activists. He believes if someone's knowingly sharing Russian disinformation, they're acting as proxies for Putin.
We have to be prepared to label what is happening to a small number, and it is a tiny number, but an influential number. They're actively promoting the talking points and disinformation of the Kremlin. I think that is objectively being pro-Putin. They can sit there all they like and say, oh, I condemn the invasion. But the tell is they're not interested in the invasion. And they never talk about the specific battles, the atrocities. They're interested in the concept of Ukraine being a puppet of an American encirclement of Russia. And so in the world of information, the first question we should always ask is cui bono, who benefits? If my friends in Kiev, who are, you know, ex-students now in uniform, suddenly run out of bullets, what will happen to them? They will surrender, and if they're unlucky, they'll be shot. That cui bono, who benefits from stopping the arms to Ukraine, is Vladimir Putin.
I suggested to Justin Schlossberg that his tweets provoked anger, not because he was diverging from the mainstream narrative, but because he was joining the Russians in questioning the facts.
Do you understand why a lot of people were upset by this? Because they saw that it was shared by the Russian state and by Russian outlets like RT in order to try and discredit reports that there was a massacre there.
One of the real, I think, problems in the way in which disinformation is framed and problematized in a lot of if you want to call it pro-Western or pro-NATO discourse, is that any sort of line that kind of departs from the Western official line is, of course, going to be ammunition to the Kremlin's disinformation campaign. And, of course, they're going to pick up on it and they're going to amplify it.
Justin Schlossberg isn't the only academic who's been criticised for the misinformation he's shared.
Welcome to Edinburgh Waverley, where we finish our journey today.
I'm in Scotland to meet a Ukrainian student who's taken issue with a professor at her university.
Most of my family is still in Ukraine. I do have some family members currently in the army who are fighting in the east.
Kvitka Perehenets has a confidence that suggests someone much older than her 21 years. As a history and politics student at Edinburgh University, she's been anxiously following the war from a distance and following Russian claims that Ukrainians are faking attacks.
I think all of those are attempts at ridding themselves of any responsibility for the crimes that have been carried out by the Russian military, because all of those claims have been debunked on numerous occasions.
Russian disinformation's nothing new to Kvitka. But finding out that a professor at her own university was sharing some of that same propaganda came as a shock.
The sort of prestige that normally is attributed to being an academic is being debased in the process of such claims being retweeted. The moment we start to equate the two sides in the story is the moment we lose our humanity, because there are no two sides to this. The oppressor, in this case Russia, should not be given the same kind of platform as those who are being oppressed should be given. It feels very dehumanizing. In a way.
The professor Kvitka's complaining about is Tim Haywood, a specialist in environmental political theory who's very active on Twitter. He came to prominence a few years ago after sharing conspiracy theories about chemical attacks in Syria and more recently about COVID-19 restrictions.
1-2-1-2, I'll be speaking a bit like this.
1-2-1-2, I'll be probably speaking a bit like this.
You're supposed to say 3-4-3-4.
Professor Haywood and I meet in the relative quiet of an upstairs room in a pub in central Edinburgh. I wanted him to talk me through his tweets about the bombing of a hospital in Mariupol in the first weeks of the war. He shared information about it at the time.
Well, one of them was the Russian Federation pointing out that there had been advice from the ground prior to the event that a maternity hospital number 1 had been taken over by the military. And that turns out to have been true.
This event got a lot of coverage at the time, but in case you missed it, here's what happened. On March 9th, there was an airstrike on a maternity hospital in Mariupol. It left an enormous crater in the ground, killing three people, including a child, and injuring another 17. Professor Hayward retweeted a Russian official saying they had evidence that hospital number one was controlled by the Ukrainian military and empty of patients. But then, did that mean all the reports of victims were wrong? Not quite, because although hospital number one was empty, that was actually a random hospital 8 kilometres away, not the maternity hospital that was bombed.
What wasn't mentioned there is actually that the hospital that had the explosion by it was hospital number three. So that was a bit misleading, and I wasn't aware of that at the time I tweeted.
Professor Hayward found this out a few weeks later and tweeted an update as soon as he realised he'd fallen for Russian disinformation.
But nonetheless, I stand by the statement that I appended to that tweet, which is that we should strive to hit both sides because, as you know, that story is still not completely verified exactly what happened.
What do you think happened at the maternity hospital in Mariupol?
I honestly don't know, but that's exactly my point. I can't confidently say. Well, I'm just going by the witness, Mariana, who said in an hour-long interview that they hadn't heard any aircraft.
Mariana Vishamirsky was something of an Instagram celebrity before the war. She was 9 months pregnant and happened to be a patient in the hospital when it was bombed. The images that emerged from that hospital bombing are some of the most haunting in the war. They show Mariana, heavily pregnant, wearing spotty pyjamas with a pink duvet draped over her shoulders as she stands in the rubble and the devastation. On her face are scratch marks and an expression of utter bewilderment. The Russians accused her of being an actress, pretending to be injured.
Hospital was a fake, and we have very serious reasons to believe that it was a fake, and we insist on that.
A few weeks later, a video emerged of Mariana in the Russian-controlled south of the country. In it, she explained she was a real patient, not an actress. But she also said she hadn't heard any planes in the sky and couldn't confirm there'd been an airstrike. By this point, the Russian state had moved on to a new denial. Now it wasn't that they'd bombed an empty hospital, but instead that they hadn't bombed a hospital at all. And the woman who they'd at first accused of being an actress was now a witness to the fact that there'd been no airstrike. The Ukrainians had used explosives to fake the bombing. So what really happened?
I spent quite a lot of time trying to track down where Mariana had gone.
So, bit confusing. There are two Marianas here. The BBC's Mariana, who's speaking to me, managed to find Ukrainian Mariana to ask her about how she came to be accused of being a fake patient by the Russians.
First and foremost, she explains to me how offensive it was to be told that she was acting because she lived through it. And funnily enough, state media did not say, oh, Mariana's actually come out now and said she wasn't acting. That bit, radio silence. But they talk about all the other things which are more complicated, ambiguous. She was unclear as to where the explosions had come from. They were rushed down to the basement very quickly, and her and the other girls, she says, who were down there with her, were unsure. They hadn't heard aeroplanes.
It puts a reasonable doubt whether it was an aircraft. My understanding, certainly at the time when I tweeted, was that it was uncertain what had happened, and now, to my knowledge, it still is.
So if it wasn't an aircraft, what could the other possibilities be?
Well, I suppose a missile is a possibility, a rocket or something, and a bomb on the spot. I guess I'm not a ballistics expert.
The Kremlin suggested it might have been an explosion carried out by Ukrainians on the ground. Professor Hayward hasn't gone as far as that, but he hasn't ruled it out. When you're trying to understand what happened in any given event in a complex war, Mariana Spring says it's best to avoid focusing on just one testimony or one particular piece of evidence.
It's about looking at a whole range of different things. There's evidence from the journalists on the ground, footage that they have subsequently released, where you can hear the aeroplanes, and a crater which, a variety of different experts say couldn't have been created by something that was an explosion that happened there on the site. It very much looked like it had come from above. You absolutely have to interrogate everything, but that doesn't mean everything is true.
Raising doubts about something that's established is obviously disinformation. My point is always that acquiring knowledge involves investigation, research and reasoning. If that's always going to be dismissed as disinformation, I think it's a very dangerous line to go down.
It's always possible to raise doubts about any event.
Well, some doubts are more reasonable than others. I mean, the basic point is we all have to trust someone.
Now, this isn't the first time I've come across Professor Tim Haywood. 2 years ago, I made a series for the BBC called Mayday about Russian and Syrian disinformation about the White Helmets. They're the Syrian first responders who pull people out from the rubble of bombed-out buildings. In that series, I reported on the Working Group on Syria, Propaganda and the Media, a collective of academics and self-styled journalists. Among their ranks are 9/11 deniers and COVID conspiracy theorists and people accused of anti-Semitism. Tim Haywood's on the group's steering committee. The Working Group have published papers outlining the theory that the White Helmets are a fake organisation controlled by Western intelligence and that they're staging rescues with the help of child actors and that they may have been involved in faking chemical attacks in Syria. But the University of Edinburgh and Professor Haywood have always maintained that his affiliation with the Working Group and his tweets are entirely separate from his academic work.
Yeah, of course it is. I tweet as an individual, I tweet as a citizen, and my work I do at the university. Some of the things that I've learned from the experience of engagement in social media have fed in to academic work. I try to use examples I'm familiar enough with to say something reasonably informed about.
Would you share that lecture with us?
I'm not sure, but I mean, maybe. I mean, the material that I use, I'm quite happy to have it looked at, yeah.
That would be great. I would be really interested to see that.
Oh, look to that then.
While we waited for Professor Haywood to send us the lecture, we got chatting to one of his students.
They're amazing.
Thank you. I really like posters. I've got one, for example, Make Prisons Obsolete. We're prison abolitionists.
Pretty radical.
Yeah.
And this one?
This one, Why Ukraine Matters. So, yeah, just to remind everyone that we're in support of Ukraine.
Maria Angela Alejandro has blue hair and a plastic mushroom hanging round her neck. She travelled about 5,000 miles from Mexico to study history and politics at Edinburgh University.
I took this course, Global Justice and Citizenship, that's the name, last semester.
The course was taught by Tim Haywood. And he made a good first impression.
I really wanted to like Tim Haywood. There's not very many professors who take a more leftist stance. Some of the stuff that Tim Haywood covers, I mean, a lot of it is like criticism of like free markets and, I mean, stuff that I find really interesting. But then it starts getting a bit weird.
And in what way is it weird?
He talks about the Working Group on Syria, Propaganda and Media, and that they're being silenced by the media and that, like, you know, they should be listened to because conspiracy theories can sometimes be true.
And what is the conspiracy theory? Do you remember?
Yes, that there was a chemical attack in Syria, but the Working Group that he is part of has proposed that the chemical attack wasn't done by the Assad government and the Russians. It was actually done by the White Helmets.
By this point, I was really keen to listen to Professor Haywood's lecture for myself, but I'd received a disappointing email. He changed his mind about sharing it with us. Instead, he told us, "I do not teach about the wars in Ukraine and Syria." But here's a clip from week 6 of the course.
The applied task for this week is a somewhat unusual one for a political theory course.
Syrian first responders who risk their lives to save others in war-torn Aleppo.
Which was borne witness to by the White Helmets and which prompted a bombing raid on Syria by the US. UK,
this particular lecture does deal with events in Syria. The university doesn't allow students to share lectures with journalists, So Maria Angela couldn't give me this recording of Tim Hayward's lecture, and I can't tell you how I got hold of it. But it essentially sets out the working group's arguments for why they suspect one particular chemical attack in the Syrian town of Douma in 2018 may have been staged with the help of the White Helmets. This is him delivering that lecture.
One narrative says the White Helmets helped rescue victims, provided evidence and gave witness statements about the chemical attack on Douma on 7th of April 2018. The critics say the White Helmets were responsible for staging a false flag event to spur the West to attack the Syrian government. In fact, dispute about this case is still current.
There's lots of context missing from the lecture recordings we've heard. Like the fact that the Syrians and Russians have been accused of carrying out over 300 chemical attacks. Missing, too, are the other investigations that the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons carried out, which found that there was very strong evidence of chemical weapons use in Syria. But here's an important clue as to why Professor Hayward focuses on one particular chemical attack. Towards the end of the lecture, he says,
"If this one case were proven false, then all the others are immediately cast into doubt. So there is a great deal at stake."
I was quite disgusted, really. I just don't like this idea of denying human rights abuses and denying violence.
We're on campus again, but this time it's further south.
This is one of the most prestigious universities in the world. I find it very intellectually soothing and serene to be in this gorgeous environment surrounded by bookstores and by libraries and by, you know, prestigious names who've studied here.
Nader Hashemi's showing us around Cambridge University. Actually, he's normally based at the University of Denver. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies there. But he's a visiting scholar here at Wilson College and the Center for Islamic Studies. He knows a lot about the conflict in Syria. And so a few days ago, we sent him a recording of Professor Hayward's lecture. What did you think?
Well, I was fundamentally horrified. He couches his lecture in the language of global justice and citizenship, purporting to be objective, purporting to be balanced. He's really engaged in, I think, a deeply distorted set of teachings and lectures.
What was it exactly in the lecture that particularly concerned you?
To focus on the White Helmets as being the problem against the backdrop of a borderline genocide really ends up raising fundamental questions about the ethics of people like Tim Hayward and his group. My understanding is that Tim Hayward is an environmental political theorist. He's not an expert on issues of war, peace, and propaganda, particularly in the context of Syria.
The rest of the course, a lot of the case studies he draws from are case studies around the environment and global poverty and food poverty and things that do seem to fall under his umbrella.
Well, fine. If he has qualifications to teach on those topics, then no objection whatsoever. But students are saying, look, this is a professor that sort of seems very reasonable, presents both sides on all of these other global issues. Why not listen to him on the question of Syria? So for most students taking the course, they would not be able to detect, I think, the deep ideological bias that Tim brings to the study of Syria.
And that seems to have been the case for Professor Hayward's student, Maria Angela.
Initially, when he presented this, I was like, could be true for all I know. But then I, you know, talked to a friend about it who's very, you know, very much informed about this. And my friend was like, this is not right. All of this is misinformation.
So should Tim Hayward be prevented from presenting his personal views in his lectures?
We should not get into the business of deep censorship on university campuses. When you go down that particular road, it becomes a disaster in terms of the question of academic freedom.
Is it important what academics like Tim Hayward say?
I would say yes and no. No in the sense that these people are very marginal, but they do have, I think, a lot of influence. This is where they're dangerous among young people and people who are politically active on the left.
The University of Edinburgh wouldn't comment on Professor Hayward specifically, But they did tell us that all credit-bearing courses and programmes across the university are subject to approval by a board of studies. The board and external examiners also keep the teaching, learning and assessment methodologies under review. They also told us that the university is committed to academic freedom and that it's their duty to make sure it's a safe place for controversial topics to be discussed. But they went on to say they take a strong view against the spread of misinformation and take complaints of that nature seriously, and they encourage students to use official channels to report their concerns. Professor Hayward told us his course asks whether we should accept a claim simply based on someone's authority, so it was clear to the students that this applied to their teachers' words too. He also repeated his claim that he doesn't teach about Syria, but simply used an example in his class that he was familiar with.
So the first thing to say is I do not trust any media over any other media.
I was interested to understand why Dr. Justin Schlossberg from Birkbeck University was sharing Russian news outlets reporting on the war in Ukraine. As someone who's built his career on understanding the media, how discerning is he?
I watch RT. I've been on RT. And I see blatant examples of disinformation. I also see what looks to me like some very good journalism that's actually not been done by the BBC.
So for you, are they equivalent? You treat them all as equivalent? The BBC, The Times, The Guardian, The Grey Zone, Mint Press News, RT?
I would not say that they're equivalent. I would say, for example, that the BBC, you're far more likely to find critical coverage of the British government in the BBC than you are to find of the Kremlin on RT. That's absolutely a function of the different ways in which those organisations are structured and controlled. There is absolutely a difference, but it's not as much of a difference as a lot of people assume.
Justin Schlossberg's faced particular criticism online for sharing a video of a self-styled reporter, Patrick Lancaster. In a previous report, Patrick aired what seemed to be an obvious piece of Russian disinformation.
We're here on the scene of what the local authorities here are calling a terrorist attack by Ukraine forces.
Days before the war started, he reported about an apparent Ukrainian military attack on two civilian vehicles in the Russian separatist Donbass region. It was quickly pointed out that the cars were old, burnt-out wrecks, and the bodies inside showed clear signs of having previously undergone autopsies. We tried contacting Patrick Lancaster but got no response. I wondered whether this was enough to discredit the reporter in Justin Schlossberg's eyes.
No, and I'll explain why. I don't know, and I suspect maybe that no one knows whether, you know, he was complicit in the staging or whether it wasn't an error. Does that mean that I distrust them? No. Why? Because it is fundamental to journalism's contribution to democratic life that journalists be allowed to get it wrong. Because journalism has to be a risky business. And if it's not a risky business, then it's not real journalism.
Justin Schlossberg and Tim Hayward aren't the only academics accused of spreading misinformation, and there are journalists, musicians and other public figures too. But how concerned do we really need to be? After all, these are a relatively small number of individuals voicing their personal views on Twitter. The war's hundreds of miles away. What effect could they really be having on geopolitics?
So my name is James Roscoe, and I am the UK ambassador to the General Assembly here in the UK mission to the UN. I think this is the most significant issue of our era, and this contest around truth has become this global struggle.
James Roscoe and delegations from other countries at the UN have been trying to figure out what to do about the Kremlin using and abusing the institution to launder their propaganda. In December 2019, the Russian ambassador to The Hague referred to the working group Tim Hayward is a part of to bolster their denials about chemical attacks.
It's significant because the entire international system, in some ways, rests on facts. You can have an international system that's based on rules unless you're able to discern whether someone is breaking those rules or not. And if they break those rules, there needs to be a consequence for doing so. So the biggest challenge to us is the whole international system stops functioning unless you can hold people to account.
When, for example, the General Assembly is asked to vote on pressurising Syria to comply with the demands of the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, then any doubts about chemical attacks being sown by Russia can have a real effect. And of course, there are concerns that this could be an issue when the UN begins investigating war crimes in Ukraine, too. Because, James Roscoe says, member states don't always see through the disinformation.
What they hear is this fact is disputed. And that's the critical thing, I think, in all of this. They hear that there are two sides to this story, and they're not in a position to make a decision one way or the other. And the way that feeds into the UN is that they're stuck in the middle.
We're probably in the middle of something like a 50-year effort by Russia to redraw the map of Europe. And in that effort, the degradation of facts into maybes is really important.
Paul Mason again. He says each individual piece of disinformation churned out by Russia has a particular trajectory of its own.
All that Russia needs is for that fact, that false fact, to embed itself in a commonly accepted view. The persistent dissemination of small lies adds up to a big false picture of history. It goes from newspapers to academia. It goes from academia to political science and into diplomacy. And Russian diplomats will start to quote the view of an academic that this is really the truth and this is false. It's like flooding the system with noise. But in the context of this war, it has another purpose. It's to undermine our ability and our willingness to defend our own democracies. It's to convince us that there's no difference between a country like America and Russia, and therefore the values that are at stake in this systemic conflict aren't really worth fighting for. So, yes, it matters.